What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. Their cause must be our cause too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
Welcome to livingthedream.org podcast. I'm Giannis, and I'm here with Mark Updegrove. Mark is the author of Indomitable Will, LBJ in the Presidency, and the director of the Lyndon Baines Johnson Presidential Library. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. So, Mark, LBJ has long been my favorite president and definitely the most interesting president in modern American history. I think that's hard to dispute. His personality is fascinating, and he was right there in the center of all of the hailstorm that was going on in the 60s. So I want to start with something that you brought up in your introduction to your book, which, by the way, for folks who aren't familiar with it, is a collection of first-person accounts of the Johnson administration from many of President Johnson's close aides, family, political friends and foes, and even choice quotes from the president himself. So, Mark, in your introduction, you say that history does not blow a kiss to presidents like Harry Truman, George H.W. Bush, and LBJ, all of whom had to follow glamorous leaders who could connect so well with the American people and play well on television, as is often required of the modern president. So I want to ask about President Johnson's legacy, not in the eyes of presidential historians, but of the public at large. We have such a strong legacy of the Great Society still staring at us in the face. Medicare, Medicaid, the Fair Housing Act, the immigration reform he passed, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Clean Air Act, Head Start, Pell Grants. How did this immense body of work not survive and give him a stronger legacy?
Well, it certainly survived, as you pointed out, Giannis, but you're right. It doesn't reflect always on President Johnson's legacy. One of the things you didn't mention, but is that I think is the most prominent aspect of his legacy, is civil rights. It's remarkable.
Oh, of course, yeah.
What he accomplished in civil rights. He is the civil rights president. I think you pointed at it. I think President Johnson had a poor public image when he was in office, particularly in the latter part of his term, and he continues to have a poor image because I think cursory history, as I mentioned in the book, is often predicated by how well a leader shows up in photographs and in broadcast footage through sound bites and through the vision that they had for this country. And I don't think that, as I mentioned, LBJ would win no beauty contests. And so often history in its most cursory form is a beauty contest, and it blows a kiss to those who are most visionary and eloquent. President Johnson was not those things. What he was, in his words, was a doer. He got things done. And one of the things, the quotes that I related in the book is from Liz Carpenter, who was an aide to President Johnson. And in comparing JFK to LBJ, said, you know, I think you can compare, you can summarize a president in one word. And Kennedy inspired, which Johnson was incapable of doing, and Johnson delivered. And I think it's true. He did deliver. He got things done. That's his legacy.
I mean, when you look at the long list, in fact, I think there's an exhibit. I've gone to the LBJ Presidential Library, and I think in one of the videos, there's just a montage at the end of all the legislation that he passed on an annual basis. Did people at the time recognize how significant this barrage of Great Society legislation was, or was it almost like too dense in a sense? I mean, were people aware at the time of how significant this was?
Well, let me answer your question, but I'm in my office as we speak, and I'm looking at a shadow box which contains the pens of all of the pens that he used to sign bills into law throughout one year, 1965. And that was working with the 89th Congress. During that calendar year, he got the following things passed. The elementary, and this is just some of them, the Elementary Secondary Education Act, Medicare, the Voting Rights Act, the Arts and Humanities, which creates the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowments for the Humanities, the Immigration Act of 1965, Clean Air, Clean Water, the Higher Education Act. I mean, this is just one single mm-hmm. year, and every one of these laws resonates today. And if a president had one of those laws that I just mentioned to point to during his entire term in office, it would be significant. But this is just one single year. So it's remarkable what he did. Were people aware of the significance of them? I think that they were. I think they were certainly aware of the significance of federal aid to education, which was the first time that had ever happened. Mm-hmm. And that's the Elementary Secondary Education Act and Higher Education Act. I think they were aware of the importance of the Immigration Act, which lifted quotas that we had around allowing certain people from non-European parts of the world into this country. They were definitely aware of the importance of the Voting Rights Act, which came in the wake of the bloody events in Selma, Alabama, part of the Civil mm-hmm. Rights Movement. And I think they were certainly aware of Medicare, which was, which FDR, Truman, and Kennedy all tried in vain to pass during their tenures in office. So, but did they think that they would continue to resound, 50 years after the fact? I don't know. But we continue to feel those effects in earnest today.
So both in your book, talking about his force of nature personality in the White House, and in Robert Caro's Master of the Senate, where he talks about the effectiveness with which he wielded the Senate Majority Leader position, you get an image of a person who, as you said, just got things done. But he also was in a historical period where, there were activists like Martin Luther King, you had the Warren Court, you had liberal senators like Hubert Humphrey and the Kennedy brothers. What lessons about LBJ's force of nature personality do you think are imputable to today's presidential leaders? Like when Barack Obama was just having a disastrous time getting health care passed, do you think that LBJ's personality and knowledge, for example, of what every senator cared about in his home state would actually be useful in today's political climate?
I think it's different, but I do think that LBJ had a certain psychological read on people that was invaluable in his efforts, in his lobbying mm-hmm. efforts. He was the most persuasive guy in Washington. I don't think there are a few who would dispute that fact, and there was something known as the Johnson treatment, which was legendary mm-hmm. in Washington. And he knew what to do to get people who mattered to say yes. And it might have been cajoling or flattering or threatening, or there were all these different tactics
sure.
that he used in order to get his way on things, which leads to the title Indomitable Will. I think if somebody in Washington or wherever in the world had will like that and had persuasive powers like those that Lyndon Johnson exhibited, they're going to get their way on things. But I do think that there was a different climate in Washington at the time, a very different environment. And one of LBJ's, well, his favorite biblical proverb was from the book of Isaiah, and it was, "Come, let us reason together." And I think his greatest lament would be the fact that there in today's Washington is very little reason and very little togetherness. And he mm-hmm. would hate the fact that there's really such such discord and animosity and acrimony between the parties.
Would he have been, I think one of the ways he was able to use his personality so forcefully is that he was able to engender trust in very disparate people, like Richard Russell, who considered him almost like a son on one hand, while on the other hand, civil rights leaders and labor union leaders felt like they could call him up. Do you think that kind of balancing act is possible in today's media and political climate?
Well, it's an astute observation, Jonas, and I the answer is I don't know, and you're absolutely right. One of the things is, Johnson is looked today as being sort of controversial in effect and sort of had a flawed character, which is certainly true. But you're right, he did engender trust across the aisle. And one of the things that you see in this is that the reason that he was able to enact that remarkable slate of legislation that I just enumerated is because he did have a facility to reach across the aisle, and that was there was this collegiality that existed today that doesn't necessarily exist today. I think certainly Lyndon Johnson would have his way on certain issues if he were in the White House today. Would he have the percentage of successes that he had back then? Probably not. It's just, again, it's a very, very different climate.
So with the other remarkable thing about his legacy is that even for progressives who really, you know, love all the things that came out of the Great Society, it's hard to reconcile Vietnam. And, of course, this was true at the time as well. And somewhat tragically, something that he was acutely aware of the entire time he was president. So I guess reading your book made me think hard about Vietnam, because you highlight the near unanimity of the Johnson administration in its march to war and buildup of a number of troops in Vietnam, and note how George Ball, the undersecretary, was one of the only people who dissented out loud at the time. And even he could not come up with an alternative strategy to stopping the domino effect in Southeast Asia, which was President Johnson's big concern. So on the one hand, that kind of seems to exonerate him a little bit, because he really didn't seem like he had a lot of political options, especially because Barry Goldwater was running on a kind of more hawkish platform than he was in the 64 election. But then on the other hand, you know, if a book came out 40 years from now that explained that all of George W. Bush's advisors were recommending war in Iraq, that wouldn't, to me, absolve President Bush of his decision as commander-in-chief, as president, to go into Iraq. So I wonder if, you know, what your thoughts are on his lack of singular leadership on that issue versus the way he grabbed the bull by the horns on so many domestic issues.
Well, I would argue that there was leadership on Vietnam. It was just not the right leadership in retrospect.
Okay.
He was very firm in his belief that we should be in Vietnam. But one of the things you can see, and as you saw in reading the book, is he was racked with anxiety as it related to the war. I mean, we have this. There are a lot of misconceptions about Johnson. And I'm certainly not a Johnson apologist. I take pride in the fact that I think this is a very balanced account of LBJ's administration. That's why I wanted to make it an oral biography. So you heard from friends and foes and aides and adversaries and, you know, a myriad of voices, so that there is this even-handed look at him. But I will say that the misconception about him is that he was a warmonger. This is not a man who wanted to be in Vietnam. And there's a very telling conversation that he has with McGeorge Bundy in 1964, when he says, "What the hell is Vietnam to me? I can't win and I can't get out," essentially. And it is, you could hear it. And he spent most of his term in office trying to seek, elusively, as it ultimately turned out, an honorable peace in Vietnam. We didn't want to be there. But he also felt, you know, we couldn't walk away from that war, because it was an article of faith in Cold War doctrine at the time that the domino theory would play out. If you didn't stave off communist insurgency in certain parts of the world, and he believed firmly that if you didn't keep the communists at bay in Vietnam, that the other nations of Southeast Asia and ultimately in other parts of the world would fall, due to the fact that you would be emboldening the Soviets and or the Chinese. He was very much aware of the lessons of Munich and always had in mind the capitulation of Neville Chamberlain in Munich in 1939, and who came back to the United Kingdom to proclaim peace in our time, and instead we got World War II. He thought that by keeping the communists at bay in Vietnam, we were ultimately preventing World War III.
Mm-hmm. Do you, from your research of that period, was there an answer to the question he was looking for from Undersecretary Ball as to what is my alternative, coming from somewhere else, you know, outside the administration? Because I know very few elected officials, you know, vote against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, only two, right? So, I mean, was there really an answer to the question he was looking for?
Yeah, there was, but it came later in the administration. One of the chapters I devote to that is called.
Sure, I meant like, you know, in like 65 or so.
There really wasn't, no. And there was thunderous support for the war, not only in the halls of Congress, but throughout this country. You know, there was no reason to believe that we needed to extricate ourselves from Vietnam. It seemed like, again, because of accepted Cold War doctrine, you know, the support that he had, there was no reason to question that we were doing the right thing. It also looked like we could handily win that war. And ultimately, we probably could have won the war. We just didn't have the will to fight it after the Tet Offensive in 1968.
So one thing that was startlingly news to me is that President Johnson's two son-in-laws served in the Vietnam War while he was president, which I actually had not heard before. And it really makes you think differently about the whole, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today chant that used to be thrown at him. I wonder if could President Johnson have shifted the public's political perception of the way he was handling the war in, you know, 1967, 1968, by showing, you know, his own anguish with it and his own personal connection to it, or would that have come across at the time as you know, as weak or undermining the war effort in the context of the time?
Well, I think people were well aware that his sons-in-law were fighting the war. In fact, there's probably the most revealing presidential photo ever that I included in the portfolio of photographs in the book, and that is of LBJ listening with his head on the cabinet room table in the White House, listening in anguish to a tape recording from his son-in-law Chuck Robb in Vietnam, and that tells the whole story. Johnson's was a very personal presidency, but Vietnam was also a very personal war for him. For the reasons that you suggested. One of the things, as I mentioned, there's a chapter in the book that relates a memo that LBJ had received from CIA Chief Dick Helms that talks about the fact that there might be a way out of Vietnam. And this is a very significant memo that wasn't even declassified until earlier in this century, and 40 years after it was written. And I don't know why LBJ didn't act on that. I don't know why he didn't take the findings of the CIA more seriously. What he thought of that memo, which essentially says there is kind of a way out without us losing too much face in the world, why he didn't do something about that is lost to history.
I guess. My next question is about the LBJ Center. How long have you, the Presidential Library, how long have you been there, and what's new there? And, you know, for all the folks who either are in Austin or coming, go there for the South by Southwest pilgrimage every year, you know, what would you like to say about it?
Well, I hope you will come by. This was the fifth of the 13 presidential libraries that we currently have in the United States. This was dedicated by President Johnson and incumbent President Richard Nixon in May of 1971. So we've been around for over 40 years. But we are doing a whole lot that is kind of shaking this place up. We have a $10 million renovation of our core exhibit on President Johnson that we're currently undergoing right now. It'll be ready by December of this year. We have ongoing programming here at the library that focuses on the issue that are important to us today. And we've had some major folks here. And just in the last year, we've had Mikhail Gorbachev and Sandra Day O'Connor, Jimmy Carter, Robert Redford, Bob Woodward, and Carl Bernstein. Julian Bond, and on and on and on. It's a remarkable slate of folks. So we would love for anyone to join us as a friend of the LBJ Library to participate in that programming or to visit our museum, which, again, is undergoing this state-of-the-art renovation.
Which is great. I mean, it was already pretty good when I was there in 2006. I'd spent the year in 2005 and 2006 doing a relief in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and I was on a road trip taking a few days off from that work, and was able to access the Hurricane Betsy files, which is a pretty remarkable story about President Johnson that you don't hear about a lot in conventional circles, about his response to the flooding of large parts of New Orleans in 1965, and how he responded essentially by taking a call from Senator Long and flying out the day after the flood and dedicating the Army Corps of Engineers to building the levee system that eventually failed. But it was really a stirring story of how quickly he jumped into action, even in the midst of this crazy year that you've already described.
You know, it's an example of crisis leadership, of great crisis leadership. And Vietnam notwithstanding, LBJ, I think, was a remarkable crisis manager. And you see that in the wake of the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and of Martin Luther King and of Bobby Kennedy and so many of the other things, the travails that he faced during the course of his administration. Vietnam is the one major flaw. And again, I think that's something you have to put in perspective. You have to look at it in the context of the Cold War. It doesn't make it any more right, but it does make his path a little more understandable.
So your book came out recently. Another big LBJ book is coming out in a few weeks, The Passage of Power by Robert Caro. And it's going to cover the years 1958 to 1965. I think some people had thought that it might cover the whole presidency at one point. But as a presidential historian and somebody who is committed to building an understanding about President Johnson, what do you most excited about with this book coming out, and what have you thought generally of the Robert Caro series?
I think, you know, any scholarship on LBJ is positive as far as I'm concerned. I think Caro's a remarkable writer, and he's earned a slew of awards for his work, and it's well deserved. But one thing is, one of the reasons that I wrote this book is because, again, I wanted a more balanced view of LBJ, and I think that the things that I had heard about Caro's work from people who know him is that he concentrates on the most negative aspects of who Johnson was at the expense of a more even-handed portrait. That's why I made this an oral biography, and again, I focus on the presidency in this. And Caro is principally focused on the vice presidency in this new volume. He is, he's created an opus, and it's very compelling reading. But I wanted to ensure that you're getting a portrait of Johnson from multiple voices, not just from one voice.
Sure. And I guess one last question. President Johnson is undeniably the most colorful president of the last, probably since TR, maybe. Do you think that his style, his bravado, his storytelling prone to exaggeration, his sense of humor, do you think that kind of personality would still, we'll see someone like that in today's politics where, you know, one misstep and you're the leading story on the blogosphere and the 24-hour news cycle?
You know, it's hard to say. I think Lyndon Johnson would have been successful in whatever area he chose. He chose politics, and I think that's a positive thing for this country because he probably has had a more transformative effect on this country than any president in your or my lifetime. But I think I kind of liken him to a Steve Jobs. If you look at Steve Jobs and what he did at Apple, it was through indomitable will and having a vision for what he wanted to create. He wasn't always the most pleasant guy to be around. He wasn't always the easiest guy to work for or work with. He certainly had a flawed character, but he left an indelible mark. And so I think that there's some similarities there. I don't know. I'm certain that he would be successful in the political world. But because of the changes in that world and the environment, as I mentioned earlier, it's difficult to know what he could affect today.
All right. Well, thanks again for chatting with us, and I'll make sure to look you up when I'm in Austin.
Yeah, I look forward to that. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.